The hour 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the tax committee to order. Representative Lee moves the minutes of March 20th. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lee. We're going to mix it up a little bit here today just for fun. And members, as we move forward, a lot of you have bills in other committees. We do want to accommodate you best we can. So we're going to start with the last bill. Representative Elkins moves House File 1697. So Representative Elkins, if you could go to the front desk there. So Representative Elkins moves House File 1697 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Great motion. Two-year bill, sir.
Thank you. We'll try and keep this quick and on time. So railroading is a capital intensive. Minnesota short line railroads across the state collectively have maintenance and construction needs of upwards of $274 million in the next 5 years. Many of these railroads are still running a 90-pound track, whereas today's standard of for handling 286,000-pound rail cars is 115 pounds. I know that one of my constituents has identified one of those 90-pound sections of track in a short-line railroad in Bloomington. Short-line tax credits help these railroads budget and plan their annual maintenance and capital programs. In 2023, I authored the Short-Line Infrastructure Modernization, or SLIM, tax credit, which was enacted as part of the omnibus tax bill. The tax credit provides an income tax credit for rail infrastructure improvements over short-line railroads that are equal to 50% of the qualified railroad construction or replacement expenditures, capped at 3,000 miles per track mile of track owned or leased by the railroad. The credit can be claimed by the eligible taxpayer or transferred to another taxpayer subject to the income or income tax premium in Minnesota. In the standalone bill I introduced in 2023, it stated that an eligible taxpayer may transfer the credit allowed under this section by written agreement to an eligible transferee at any time during the 5 years following the taxable year in which the qualified expenditures are incurred. In the final 2023 omnibus tax bill, however, the language is altered to read, and nobody caught it at the time, an eligible taxpayer may transfer the credit allowed under this section as by written agreement of an eligible transferee. The amount of the transferred credit is limited to the unused remaining portion of the credit. So transferability is a critical component of the program since it serves as a mechanism to finance expensive rail infrastructure improvements. The timing of the transferability of the tax credit impacts the ability to fund track improvements. So this file, since the error was discovered, the Departments of Revenue and Transportation, along with representatives of the railroad industry, have been working on a fix. And House File 1697 reflects the results of these conversations. Under the bill, MnDOT would be responsible for issuing a credit certificate to an eligible taxpayer who would transfer any amount of the credit before it is claimed or the entire amount of the credit carryover in each of the five succeeding taxable years. This change is supported by the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association and is part of the governor's budget recommendations.
Thank you very much, Representative Elkins. Anyone else would like to testify on it? Are you here for support or would like to testify?
Mr. Chair, I can just answer questions. Chair, Representative Elkins covered it very well. So.
Okay, I mean, you can certainly testify if you'd like. Anyone in the audience who would like to testify for the bill or with concerns? Okay, the department, have any, where's the department? Is the department here? Yeah, okay. Would you like to testify? Well, if she comes back and wants to talk about it, we'll certainly let her. Okay, members, questions to Representative Elkins? Okay, thank you very much. You want to wrap it up there, Representative Elkins?
I think everything that needs to be said has been said.
Okay. I will renew my motion, or Representative Elkins will renew his motion that House File 1697 be laid out for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank
and
you.
Just for members and for the audience, if you followed the Commerce Committee meeting at all, I just want to go on the record, I am very much against fraud, just so you know that. I think fraud is bad, and just to clear the record up.
Mr. Chair, what did I miss?
Representative Robbins?
Just wondering what I missed about the Commerce Committee and fraud.
Well, it was, Representative Robbins was very exciting. There were some things said that were untrue. And so we may have to go to before your committee just to clean it up a little bit.
You are always welcome, Mr. Chair.
I hope I never come before that committee. I'm sure it's a great committee. I'm sure it's well run and very good. I just don't want to be there. Okay, Anderson PH, if you could please come to the table with anyone you have to testify or to be a resource person. Welcome to the committee, Representative Anderson. I will move House File 1698 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. So members, it's 1698. Are there any amendments? And I apologize, I should have had this all out before here. Okay, Chair Anderson, to your bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. In my humble opinion, this bill is rather unique in that it fills a need for land that farmers and ranchers use for grazing cattle, and yet it doesn't cost, a net cost is zero, which it doesn't happen all that often. The Nature Conservancy, or TNC, is a nonprofit organization, and it works to conserve grasslands and promote science-based practices. And these support healthy lands that are capable of producing food and supporting our ranching and farming community. And with the loss of Minnesota's natural prairie and grassland habitat, it's important that we maintain what is left of these significant landscapes through things such as conservation tools and ecologically targeted livestock grazing. As we look back in history, grasslands developed right alongside and were flourished by the buffalo, or correctly known as bison, and we need to try to mimic the effect of this management tool through utilizing cattle. But under the current statute, if TMC were to partner with ranchers to enact some conservation grazing on these tax-exempt impacted parcels, the property tax would be triggered. And with the amount of acres available to farmers and ranchers on the decline, it's really important that we can create more avenues for them to access grazing land, and that's important to maintain our ranching community. But the cost of this tax that would be triggered is not feasible for ranchers to incur given the ecologically driven, the time-constrained, and the area-limited nature of conservation grazing that the TNC would employ. And the Minnesota Department of Revenue issued a revenue statement analysis last session that indicated the cost to the state is de minimis because the land is currently not being taxed. So House File 1698 proposes a tax exemption for conservation grazing activities that support the conservation management strategy on these nonprofit-owned lands. I'll turn the testifying over to a testifier for further comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we do that, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on behalf of the bill or with concerns? Does the department have any? Okay. So please identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Davids, and good morning, Co-Chair Gomez and committee members. My name is Liz Beery, and I am the Associate Director of Grasslands for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota, and I'm based in Fergus Falls. The Nature Conservancy is a nonprofit organization working to protect the lands and waters on which all life depends. One of the ways that we do that in Minnesota is through the protection and restoration of native prairie grasslands. Unfortunately, only around 1% of Minnesota's native prairie grasslands remain, but they can have significant benefits for carbon sequestration, water quality, and wildlife habitat, among other I'm here today to speak in support of House File 1698, which would help the Nature Conservancy conduct prairie management on certain tax-exempt lands by enabling the use of cattle grazing by private ranchers as a conservation tool. Cattle grazing is an important component in maintaining the health and vigor of our state's grasslands and is widely recognized as a cost-effective tool for prairie management. targeted conservation grazing is generally very limited in both space and duration, and when strategically employed, helps control invasive species and contributes to healthy soils. One of the greatest threats to our prairies is the invasion of cool season non-native grasses such as Kentucky bluegrass, smooth brome, and reed canary grass. Limited duration grazing early and late in the growing season is one of the best techniques we have for keeping those invasives at bay. One of the major reasons for managing these invasives is to help promote the health and vigor of native grasses and forbs, which provide maximum benefits to grassland birds, pollinators, and other wildlife. In recent years, we have engaged with individual cattle producers and state and federal agencies to come up with plans that provide additional access for producers to graze on public and TNC lands that also help to meet management goals. In addition to facilitating this collaboration, TNC has invested heavily in fencing and watering infrastructure on public lands, an effort that has resulted in expanding the acres of grass available to cattle ranchers. And while we've made good progress with respect to public lands, current law stipulates that anytime tax-exempt lands are available to a for-profit business, those lands are subject to property taxes for that year. Because conservation grazing is driven by specific ecological objectives, offering grazing leases to a for-profit rancher would generate much less revenue than the tax burden that would result. For short-term grazing on the scale of a couple weeks, cattle producers would have little or no incentive to engage in a lease with us to put their cattle on the land for that short period of time. An exemption to open these properties to further conservation objectives enables private ranchers to graze their cattle on these tax-exempt grasslands while benefiting both the producer and the conservation organization. House File 1698 would enable us to conduct rotational, ecologically driven grazing on TNC parcels and provide increased foraging to private producers. Because these lands are already tax-exempt, House File 1698 is revenue neutral to counties and other local units of government. Adopting this bill would provide a win-win solution for conservation and agriculture. We greatly appreciate this committee's past work on this proposal. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for your efforts on this bill, and thank you, co-chairs and committee, for visiting with us today on this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general question, would this be a shift then? So this would just take this property tax that would be liable to Nature Conservancy or whoever, and this other folks would pay it? So a little bit of an increase, or would are you looking for the state to kind of just repay the counties or the township or whatever it might be?
Ms. Berry?
thank you, Chair Davids and committee members. We already don't pay tax on these parcels, so effectively we're not grazing them already. Mm-hmm. We're just looking to expand our ability to manage these lands, so it's a no change, basically.
Okay. Chair Swazinski, any other questions for the testifier? I've just noticed here, if you have agriculture and the Nature Conservancy together on something, I don't know if I want to get in the way, but that's just my opinion. So, questions for Ms. Berry? Okay, Representative Smith?
On the bill generally, I don't know.
Yeah, okay, so we will go to questions to the author, then we will allow the author to wrap it up. I have Representative Smith and then Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Thank you, Chair Anderson, for bringing this. I generally think this is a good bill. It's not a bipartisan bill yet, but I'm hopeful that I will be able to sign on as an author at some point. My main concern with this is not with the parties that have brought the bill to this, but potential future parties taking advantage of somewhat broad language in the bill. If you look at the actual provisions that are added in 219 to 222, it's pretty broad. And I could see a scenario where an enterprising business person might set up a, quote, nonprofit conservation organization and potentially lease or loan large tracts of land for grazing, which I don't think is anyone's intent in this bill. So I want to be clear, I'm not charging anyone with doing that. But I do think the broad language here does provide for potential abuse in the future by someone looking at this code. So I would be more comfortable signing on as a co-author if this had a little bit more checks in place about maybe time spans or how often this might be done on a particular tract of land. Obviously, if you are actually doing conservation work, you don't want grazing continually. And so I would love to see that change in this bill, or not even a change, but an addition to this bill before it goes forward or potentially is included in a tax bill. So thank you, Chair.
Chair Anderson to the Smith concerns, Representative Smith concerns.
Chair Davids, Representative Smith, land prices are extremely high. I think it would be very difficult for anybody to purchase land and cash flow it in a situation like this where they would have a tax-exempt status and then work with a rancher or farmer because the cost of land is just too high. I just don't think it would cash flow. So I don't see that as a real issue here with somebody buying up tracts of land to do this type of thing, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
I would just respond, thank you, Chair. I would just respond that in other industries we have seen this done where corporations will use some sort of shell corporation, nonprofit, or maybe just a smaller LLC to create sort of these shell things. So I think in this particular area I would just be more comfortable. I'm just saying what I would like in the bill for me to be able to sign on, and I do think that's a concern we've seen in other industries when these sort of tax exemptions occur. And we don't want to put, no one on this committee wants to push property taxes onto farmers who are farming in land close to where these are because these are property exempt areas. So that would be my concern.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Gomez.
Representative Smith sort of covered my concern. I mean, I guess, you know, this bill is asking for an exception to you know, Section 1, Subdivision 2, which is titled Exempt Property Used by Private Entity for Profit. And so, you know, this is in a case where you have, you know, what would otherwise be exempt property that is being, you know, leased to a corporation or another entity that is a for-profit entity. And so it's basically extending the tax-exempt status that we give to, you know, institutions of pure charity, extending that tax benefit that we give them in a way to for-profit entities. And so, you know, I mean, I think that this work is really important, and I appreciate, you know, like that it is in the public interest that we have healthy land and healthy waters for ourselves and for our future generations. You know, I have just some concerns, I think. I mean, it is a shift. It's a small shift, certainly, right? But it's a shift onto other property taxpayers, as Chair Swedzinski pointed out. And so I just, you know, when we're adding, you know, if you kind of look through, you can see all the exceptions that have been added to this year after year after year after year. And so, you know, it's just, it's the kind of thing that we see in tax committee and that I just personally, like, think that we need to proceed with real thoughtfulness and caution because we have a policy that if you're an entity that controls exempt property and you are, you know, leasing it to a for-profit entity, they don't get your tax status. So that's what the underlying kind of section of law that this is modifying says. And I just want us to proceed thoughtfully and with caution on exceptions like this. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. The gentleman from Lyon.
And thank you. This would be maybe a question to nonpartisan staff. And so just a general, so one of the conversations what has been happening is now potentially with solar installations across the state, looking at doing some grazing underneath the panels. And to nonpartisan staff, how would this potentially affect that situation? So if you've got a situation where you have an increased value because there's solar panels on the land, it's conservation underneath it, would this potentially grab that in and negate some of those taxes that would be paid by those entities?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swedzinski, so the sort of an underlying premise within this bill is that the property that is being leased for grazing is already tax exempt. And in order for this type of property to be exempt from property taxes, it would need to be native prairie. So it's probably unlikely that a parcel of property that's being used as a for solar installations is also receiving this native prairie property tax exemption. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but it seems unlikely to me.
We good? Okay. Any other questions for the testifier or the author? Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Approximately how many acres are under the control of the Nature Conservancy?
Ms. Berry?
Thank you for that question. Chair Davids and committee members, I don't have the exact number of acres statewide, but in terms of this bill, we'd be talking about 30 to 40 tracts and approximately 6,000 acres scattered across several different counties, and it would, you know, none of them would be grazed all year, every year. Like we said, often short duration grazes, and that would occur as needed every few years to meet management needs.
Representative Weiner.
So, right, currently, do you use burn off or any types of those methods to control noxious weeds, brush, undergrowth?
Ms. Berry.
Yes, thank you for that question. Chair Davids and committee members, we do also use prescribed fire as a tool to manage our prairies. However, on some sites, due to topography or due to neighbors or due to other complications, we aren't able to implement prescribed fire as often as we'd like to. So having the option to use conservation grazing as a tool is really critical across many of our properties as well.
Representative Weiner.
Thank you. And then the other thing, you've mentioned beef cattle many times, but is it just limited to cattle, or sheep and goats would be okay as well?
Ms. Berry.
Thank you for that question as well. Chair Davids and committee members, it's infrequent that we graze with sheep and goats. However, some sites dictate that if we're targeting woody vegetation or specific invasive. So I guess in terms of this bill, were we anticipating including that? I imagine it was just conservation grazing in general, but yeah.
Representative Weiner.
No, I guess it kind of answers my questions. I've seen this type of methods used, animal grazing on different types of property to control the noxious weeds and so forth. And some types of animals do better, what you mentioned, with different types of vegetation. And it is definitely better than burning off in some situations because of risk of spread and the control. So actually, I'm in favor of this bill. I just wanted to understand those points a little bit more. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiner. Any other questions for the author or the testifier? Chair Gomez? Okay, then I will renew my motion that House File 1698 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Item next, I will move House File 632, an adult bill. And we do have an amendment, members. So we'll let Representative Nadeau get to the table. Representative Nadeau, would you like me to move the H0632A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I will move the H0632A1 amendment. Any discussion? This is get the bill in the shape the author like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Say no. Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended in the shape the author would like. Two-year bill, Representative Nadeau, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. This is probably the most fun bill you're going to hear today, I hope. This is all about conservation easements. And for more than a decade, assessors across the state have been prohibited from taking into account the value or the reduction in value on property values if there's a conservation easement on a particular property. I want to just remind the committee that, you know, the highest quality natural features in Minnesota are predominantly owned by private citizens. And there's and many of those people want to protect those features in perpetuity. And a conservation easement is the tool in which to do it. Also in the metro area, the amendment limits this conservation easement language and allowing an assessor to change the value of it to the metropolitan area. So this doesn't apply to outstate.
That's not how the bill was originally drafted. We thought it would be more important to have all, you know, all counties have the ability to use this tool for private individuals. But the Senate changed the language, and that's why we changed it here. So thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Conservation easements, they also limit development potential. So in my area, in Hennepin County, there's a lot of large landowners that want to preserve the natural features, the high-quality natural features of their property. And placing this land in a conservation easement would limit their ability to develop the property. So ultimately, it's a reduction in value, and that's what this bill does. House File 6632, as amended, authorizes simply county assessment in metro counties to consider the impact of conservation easements on property value. Counties have to have a resolution. They have to have a natural resource plan. So it's not something that people can just do incrementally. There has to be an overall plan in order to do this. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Wayne Ostley from the Minnesota Land Trust.
And we will certainly do that in just a moment. I have on my list Wayne Ostley, Christine Bauer, Connie LaFond, and Matt Hilgert. Is there anyone else in the audience like to testify for the bill or with concerns? Okay, we'll stick to this list then. So let's go. Mr. Ostley, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Hello. My name is Wayne Ostley. I am the Director of Land Protection with the Minnesota Land Trust. Chair Davids and committee members, thanks very much for letting me speak today on behalf of this bill. I also want to thank Representative Nadeau for carrying this bill and the opportunity to testify today. The Minnesota Land Trust holds over 750 conservation easements, protecting more than 85,000 acres of Minnesota's priority natural lands and treasured lakes and streams. This important bill is to the benefit of the landowners who have conservation easements on their land, the counties which support them, and our state's natural resources. As a bit of background, and I don't want to get into too much detail, as it was teed up initially, but a little bit of background in terms of how we got here today. So in 2010, Blandon protected nearly 300 square miles of forest land in northern Minnesota through a conservation easement facilitated by the Conservation Fund and the DNR using state and private dollars. The project was hailed as one of the most significant conservation outcomes in Minnesota at that time. The working forest easement allowed Blandon to continue to use the land for timber production and retain their holdings in Minnesota at a time when timber companies were divesting of their lands, but also provided a significant public benefit by preserving wildlife and public access for hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation. One of the outcomes of this important transaction, however, was that the value of the land on the tax rolls was diminished in line with the remaining value of the Blandon property. Despite being a major conservation achievement, the sheer size of the project resulted in an impact to the tax base in some counties. As a result of that impact, Minnesota passed in 2013 a new law that prohibited county assessors, with the exception of Dakota County and landowners with riparian lands, from considering the impacts of conservation easements on the tax value of private land. Prior to that year, landowners could have their property tax assessment adjusted by their local county assessor to fairly reflect the easement's impact on the property's market value. So why the need for this bill? While the 2013 law attempted to address impacts of large industrial forest easement transactions, the reality is that all of these transactions, all of these types of transactions, are by and large complete. There are few large corporate owners who haven't either protected their lands through easement or transferred those lands to a public owner. However, the impacts of the bill are still being felt by the small private landowners in Minnesota, and in some places this has had a chilling effect on the public's conservation goals. Prior to 2013, county assessors, regardless of where they worked in Minnesota, evaluated properties with conservation easements under the same uniform standards of practice. In some cases, values were adjusted because of the easement. In some cases, they weren't. but everyone had the opportunity to have their property fairly assessed based on the property's highest and best use as impacted by the conservation easement. That 2013 law now prevents that in most instances. The 2013 law created a number of fairness issues. Landowners contributing easements prior to 2013 operate under a different set of guidelines than those that entered into conservation easements after 2013. Landowners with similar properties but in different counties are not treated the same. Dakota County has a different practice and are allowed to use a different system than all other counties. Landowners with riparian lands may be treated fairly, while those with only uplands, such as prairies and bluffs, landowners in water-rich parts of the state may be treated more fairly than in other parts of the state. The state of Minnesota has also invested heavily in conservation easements.
Recording in progress.
Through the Outdoor Heritage Fund and other sources, and this investment has been reciprocated through the generosity of landowners. Over the past decade, landowners with whom the Land Trust has worked with across Minnesota and in the Twin Cities have donated easement value in excess of $30 million. Yet despite this level of donation, these landowners are being assessed at the full land value and are in essence being taxed on their generosity. This bill takes a modest, practical step towards addressing these issues by focusing on areas where the impact of the 2013 law is most acute, the metro. Some may raise the question about the legal impact of creating two different systems for the treatment of property taxes and easements. I would say we already have that. Dakota County has a different system than the rest of the state. Pre-2013 landowners have a different system than post-2013 landowners, and landowners with riparian lands have a different system than those with uplands. Yet no legal issues have arisen from those cases. Thank you for hearing this bill and for helping landowners and counties recognize the fairness they deserve.
Thank you, Mr. Ostley. Any questions for Mr. Ostley? Okay, we'll then go to Christine Maurer, Habitat Conservation Supervisor, Hennepin County. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Davids and Gomez and representatives. My name is Christine Maurer. I'm a supervising environmentalist at Hennepin County and the program manager of our Habitat Conservation Program, which serves residents and partners in pursuit of habitat protection and improvement through the establishment of conservation easements and restoration actions. Thank you to Representative Nadeau for carrying this bill and for the opportunity to testify today. Hennepin County supports measures to restore the ability of county assessors to determine if and how an easement may impact the property value, which was eliminated, as Wayne noted, in 2013. HF 632 advances our efforts to protect and enhance wildlife habitat and water quality by improving fairness in property taxes for folks with conservation easements, and also increases the efficiency of state conservation funds. Folks come to our program for a variety of goals: to protect family heritage, preserve rural character, protect habitat for game and non-game wildlife, and protect our environment for future generations. However, interested landowners routinely stop conversations with me and my staff about land protection after learning their property taxes can't be adjusted. For many, the combined uncertainty of future tax burdens, fluctuation in financial and real estate markets, and the loss of land value from an easement are too much financial risk, and folks are forced to walk away from their pursuit of a conservation legacy. Those with agricultural lands who are enrolled in agricultural tax incentive programs face compounded financial uncertainty as they simultaneously risk losing existing tax incentives. Property owners are voluntarily engaging in conservation action and desire property taxes to accurately reflect the impacts of conservation easements on their property values. HF 632 will not only help make land protection more accessible to more residents by reducing financial uncertainty, it will align tax policy with greater fairness and provide a meaningful acknowledgement to those who have engaged in this voluntary conservation action. Additionally, this bill will help conservation programs, including ours, be more efficient with state funds. Hennepin County and the Minnesota Land Trust have collectively received $9.3 million from the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Fund over three grant phases and have used those funds to protect 415 acres and implement over 460 acres of habitat improvement. Reduced financial uncertainty and increased acknowledgement and fairness would allow more landowners to choose to partially or fully donate their easements, allowing grant dollars to go further. Additionally, fewer projects will likely be lost, improving staff time efficiencies and reducing contracting costs. In conclusion, Hennepin County supports this bill to allow our assessors to determine if and how an easement may impact property value. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, let's go on to Connie LaFond.
My name is Connie LaFond, and I would like to thank the chairs and the committee for allowing me to testify today. I am a CPA and a landowner in the city of Independence, Minnesota. My husband and I live approximately 30 miles west of Minneapolis in western Hennepin County, and we placed approximately 53 acres in conservation easements in 2024. I have also assisted clients with conservation easements and consulted with other landowners in Hennepin County regarding conservation easements. The major financial concern with landowners considering conservation easements is the impact of real estate tax increases on conservation properties. As landowners, we are giving up a significant future financial incentive for development and agricultural use of our property. My husband and I feel that the environmental benefit and future benefit to the general public outweighs the financial issues, but many landowners do not have that same process or the ability to absorb real estate tax increases. Clarity regarding the real estate tax issue would be a great benefit to future landowner decisions. This bill would significantly reduce the uncertainty regarding taxation and assist landowners in making the decision to protect properties for future generations. Thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, if we could make room for Mr. Matt Hilgert now. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Great to be with you this morning. My name is Matt Hilgert. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. And I agree with Representative Nadeau full-heartedly about this being the most fun bill of the day. And certainly I hope to add some zazz to Mr. Osling's story since he entertain the story of Blanded. I'd love to add a little bit to that because I think it's important for members to get context of why is AMC up here on a very particular bill that only deals with metropolitan counties. And the answer to that is really because we are talking about Statute 273. And I'll start first by also saying that we are supportive of the A1 amendment and thank Representative Nadeau for his efforts on this. As Mr. Osling pointed to, this underlying statute that prohibits assessors from reducing value of a land with easement really stems from this behemoth of a case. And that's what we should remember. And I know some of you were around the legislature when we were coming screaming for assistance as four counties were talking about bankruptcy. But this really stems from a case where Blandin received a $44 million price tag and easement from the state of Minnesota, from the legacy fund mostly. I think it was $36 million in funds from the legacy. That was a $44 million purchase for lands that were about a quarter of the size of Rhode Island. So this is a big, big piece of all, I think it was 4,400 parcels combined into one easement purchase. In turn, a couple years later, they came to the tax court and said, hey, our assessed value isn't $130 million on these parcels. It should only be 20. Because now we're one single unit, and we have our bundle of property tax rights has been impacted, and therefore we should have a reduction. And the tax judge at that time agreed. And so all of a sudden, counties saw those communities, not counties, we're talking about townships, cities, counties, et cetera, saw a reduction in their tax base by 88%. For Itasca County alone, that was $2.3 million in tax revenue they lost. And even the judge at that time said there is no doubt that the policy decisions were about this underlying principle of assessors being able to reduce the value, et cetera, are committed to the sound discretion of Minnesota's legislative and executive branches. We only question whether the tax-based implications of these decisions were foreseen at the time they were taken. Even them addressing the fact that there were questions of did the legislature fully account for what possibly could happen in terms of shift. That's why this underlying statute of the value of real property shall not be reduced is there. Now, I will pause and detour by saying times change, needs changed. And that's what I really appreciate about Representative Nadeau's bill, is here we are talking specifically by the A1 amendment about counties, particularly in the metropolitan area, who have serious conservation needs. They have growing tax bases, growing development, and they are wanting to prioritize conservation. I think these two things can coexist. The concerns about other greater Minnesota counties when they see the statute while also protecting the rights of metropolitan counties that say, hey, we want these tools. And the A1 amendment, I believe, is a really good, concerted, thoughtful approach on how to do that and how to tailor it to achieve that outcome. So I want to thank Representative Nadeau, while probably not loving the fact that the bill changed a little bit in form, at least being open to hearing our statewide perspective on the underlying statute and working with us on the A1 amendment. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hilger. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, thank you very, very much. Okay, we'll now go, did the department wish to talk about this one? Okay. Questions for members? Okay, I will renew my motion that House File 632 is amended later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So, thank you, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Members, let's go. Just go right down the line here. Representative Witte, is there an amendment? Okay. Representative Witte moves House File 1352, and the motion will be to keep it in the committee. Representative Witte now moves the is the H1352A1 amendment yours, Representative Witte?
Yes, that's my wish.
Okay, so Representative Witte moves the H1352A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all fair say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, to the bill as amended, Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Thank you, Chair Gomez, and fellow tax committee members. House File 1352, a solid waste management. Definition of residential generator modified. Members, nonprofit 501c3 organizations with thrift resale operations are uniquely situated as a valuable part of our waste management system. Minnesotans generously donate millions of goods to nonprofit thrift stores every year. Providing another opportunity for diversion and reuse for items that may otherwise end up in landfill or other waste stream. And with spring upon us, it is spring cleaning time. Quite simply, nonprofit thrift retailers are not commercial producers of waste, but rather recipients of residential donations. House File 1352 offers a simple expansion of definition of residential waste to include nonprofit thrift retailers. This change creates a win-win for the community and the state. Savings realized from expanding the definition to include nonprofit thrift will be reinvested into important community programs. I'm pleased to have a strong bipartisan show of support for this bill, and I do have a testifier with me today.
Okay, Representative Witte, we have two testifiers. Is there one? Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. So I have two. Is there anyone else in the audience who testify for the bill or with concerns? Okay, let's go to Deanna. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Deanna Smiley Gulliford, and I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Goodwill Easter Seals, Minnesota. We appreciate Representative Witte bringing this bill, HF 1352, forward, along with his bipartisan co-authors, Representatives Anderson, Fisher, Hansen, Davids, and Vernig. Minnesotans, as Representative Witte mentioned, are generous donors of goods to nonprofit thrift stores. These donations provide funding for services that help connect people to critical community services. despite our successful and creative efforts to divert millions of pounds of donations from landfills annually, we still receive some items that are simply not sellable and ultimately end up in the waste stream. In Minnesota, the solid waste management state tax rate is 9.75% for residential generators and 17% for commercial generators of waste. The tax is based on the sales price charged by the trash provider and the type of waste generator. Currently, nonprofit thrift providers are taxed at the higher commercial rate. However, nonprofit thrift organizations are not generators of waste, but rather receive residential donations, most of which are diverted from the waste stream through resale or reuse efforts. Our county partners see nonprofit thrift retailers as key partners in the shared goal of diverting much of the residential donations from the waste stream, and we hope the state does as well. Including nonprofit thrift in the residential definition will impact organizations across the state and in your communities. Organizations like ARC Minnesota's Value Village, Salvation Army, your local Goodwill, and others. Savings realized will be reinvested into a wide range of important community programs, including those for individuals with disabilities, those needing food and shelter, employment training programs, and much more. Thank you for your consideration of this request, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for members for the testifier? Okay, please identify yourself for the record and provide your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, and members of the committee. My name is Emily Barker. I'm the Executive Director for Reuse Minnesota, and we are a small, we're a member-based nonprofit that represents all sorts of different kind of reuse businesses, from small and large resale businesses, thrift stores, repair shops, as well as government entities and individuals who support reuse. We support House File 1352 to amend the definition of residential generator as it relates to the solid waste management tax in order to include nonprofit resale stores that accept donations from the public. We support this change because we know that much of the material thrift stores end up putting in the garbage is coming in through donations. I have talked to numerous nonprofit thrift stores, and I personally volunteer for a small store in Minneapolis, and I know that while most of the donations are in good condition and can be put on the sales floor, some just can't be sold. Well, a lot of stores engage with community partnerships to donate things like surplus clothing, or they have recycling programs. There are some things that just, unfortunately, can't be put out. Nearly everything that's thrown away is items that are broken, things that are too dirty for a thrift store to wash on site, or unfortunately, things do come in with mold and mildew after being stored in basements and attics. Most thrift stores provide guidelines to their donors about what can be accepted. Unfortunately, during events like cleanouts or a mad dash before a move, many items are thrown in the donation bin that simply are not in a condition suitable for resale. Classifying nonprofit thrift stores to be included as in the definition of residential generator acknowledges the reality that most thrift stores face when it comes to their trash. As an organization that represents several nonprofit thrift stores, we know this change would directly benefit many organizations that are serving Minnesotans in ways beyond providing quality used goods to the public. They provide counseling, financial services, housing support, and more. By reducing the tax from the commercial rate of 17% to the residential rate of 9.75%, these organizations can invest in more in improving their businesses and the other services they provide. I also want to note that I previously worked for the MPCA and for a City of St. Louis Park, and I know that while it might not sound like a lot to reduce it from 17 to 9.5% or 9.75, this does make a big difference, and I think that this money, for folks who are not familiar, this fund goes to support recycling programs, money that comes back to the counties and then goes to the cities. And this would be overall not a huge budgetary impact. So I think that but it would mean a lot to those individual stores. So I think that that's one of the many reasons that we support it as well. So thank you for considering this bill and for supporting the reuse sector in Minnesota.
Okay, any questions for the testifier? Does the department wish to testify? Okay, members, questions overall to the bill author, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Witte, for bringing this forward. And after seeing this, I did sign on to it because in volunteering with Basic Needs and other organizations and helping them organize and behind the scenes is how much does get thrown away, or, you know, because everybody feels that because they owned it at one time, there's value to it. Mm-hmm. And then also for other reasons, they're just clearing out. It's like, oh, somebody else is going to love it as much as I do. But unfortunately, organizations get stuck with the situation. And I think allowing, you know, making a change like this doesn't allow us, the organizations who are taking in donations, from not being hurt, and then all of a sudden that money not going as far as you want it to be. So thank you for bringing forward. I think this will benefit them immensely when you actually look at how much that gets left on their door for them to try to sort through. So thank you.
Any other questions for the author? Okay, Representative Gomez. Okay, if you could wrap, did I miss somebody? Representative Lee.
Oh, thanks, Chair. Do we need to move the A1?
We did.
Oh, okay, I missed that, thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions for members? Okay, Representative Witte, you wanna wrap it up?
Yes, I appreciate your support. And with spring, it is spring cleanup in most people's houses, and just remember, one person's junk is another person's treasure. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Witte. With that, Representative Witte renews his motion that House File 1352, as amended, be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Witte. I don't know what members are thinking here, but I think that bill is more exciting than the Nadeau bill. Do you like that one better?
Mr. Chair, bold statement. All of our babies are beautiful in tax committee.
I have to agree. You're right. So I retract my previous comment. Okay, with that, we're going to mix it up a little bit here because we are waiting for some papers for the Robbins bill. So let's go to the Norris and Swedzinski bills. And we're going to have them, if they would, go up there together. They are very, very similar. So we have House File 618. There's an amendment. So, you know, can we move two bills at the same time? We're the tax committee. We can do whatever we want. So, okay. Representative Swedzinski moves House File 618. I'm going to try this. Representative Swedzinski has the amendment A1. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, and that is my motion, just to get the bill in the shape that I would prefer it to be in.
Okay, Representative Swedzinski moves the H06181A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? I passed it. Motion prevails. Okay, so I want both of these before us so we can talk about both of them. They're very similar. And Representative, is there like some staff here that knows if we can even do this? Because I'd like to move the Norris bill also and have two bills before us. We could be setting precedent. Okay. Okay. So, thank you. I'm a trendsetter here. So what we're going to do is we're going to work off House File 618 as amended, and then we'll go to the Norris bill. So we'll hear them separately. Chair Swedzinski, to your bill.
Yes, House File 618 and House File 1248, you know, have been a project of this legislative body and this committee in particular for quite a number of years. It's been keeping nonpartisan staff busy for a lot of hours. And our goal here is, you know, primarily as legislators, is to, one, represent our districts as best we can when it comes to the projects that are being built in our district by the cities or counties or nonprofits, and just really reflect the reality of what the intention of the legislature was. And years ago, the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, with a bill signed by the governor, made these entities tax exempt when it comes to sales tax. When the rubber hit the road and projects are being built, the practicalities of these projects as they're being bid through lump sum contracts found a problem. And the problem was that when we have contractors going out, purchasing 2x4s, concrete, equipment in general on behalf of those tax-free entities, aren't able to capture that sales tax exemption. And the bills that, these two bills that are before you and a myriad of others, some have been successful moving through the legislatures, others have not, on an individual basis, seeks to just clarify in law and make it a very practical way that reflects reality that would allow these projects to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars across the state. Oftentimes those sales taxes get turned into property taxes that get passed on to local units of government that quite frankly go straight to the state. And that's what this bill does. It goes through a myriad of spaces, and it allows for school districts, local governments, hospitals, nursing homes, county libraries, nonprofit groups, hospitals, and outpatient surgical centers to be captured underneath that. And so essentially the way the bill would work is as the project is being completed, those receipts would be collected, they'd be turned back into the state, and a refund would be given back to that taxable entity. Because during a lump sum contract, the bids are often included in two different ways. So the bid is, when we say lump sum, that is labor and materials. And so if, in the rare cases, maybe it's a smaller project, let's say you're doing a project for a school. If the school actually went out, purchased the 2x4, purchased the concrete, wrote a check for it, inspected it, approved it, said that it was good, then it would work. But oftentimes, those professionals don't reside within that local unit of government. The county doesn't have an inspector that understands the quality of a rafter or a cinder block or a concrete or tests it. And so the reality is you are trying to purchase something using a professional in the trades to do that work on your behalf so that it's being ensured that the quality of those products meet the standards in which will create a building that will last a lifetime. And that's what the bill does. And Representative Norris, would you like to talk a hair bit? Is that what you'd prefer,
okay,
Mr.
Yeah.
Chair?
You know, let's do that. Even though we have the Swazinski bill before us, let's have Representative Norris kind of talk to his bill, because when we get done with the Swazinski bill, we'll go to the Norris bill. And members, I think we're doing the world a favor doing it this way, because we have so many requests for this. I think we're over 60 now, maybe, if maybe staff could help me out here. We're over 60. So unless you want to sit here and listen to 60 of them, and I'm sure they're all fine projects. Both of these bills do it statewide. And then we'll have to make some decisions going forward as to how we handle things. So let's go to Representative Norris, and then we're going to go, we have a Valerie Dosland, we have a Nathan Jessen, and a Jenny Max. Is there anyone else in the audience who's testifying for this bill, basically both bills, or with concern? Okay, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and thanks to Representative Swazinski for letting me co-present. I think Representative Swazinski did a really good job of outlining what this bill does. I guess what I'll underscore is that we're not really creating any new tax exemption with this. It's just that under current law, local units of government like cities, counties, townships, and school districts are already exempted from paying state sales tax on construction materials. It's just, the way that they have to do it is impractical. And so when we talk about the administrability of our tax code, what you're seeing in the revenue estimate for this bill is actually just the impact of this particular provision in our tax code being really hard for taxpayers to comply with and to administer. And as a result, we see all these one-off bills and inequity where some communities that have the administrative capacity, that have members in the legislature with political influence, are able to get their construction material sales tax exemption through the legislature. Others are not, and so these two bills, both would try to level the playing field and make our tax code easier for our local units of government.
Thank you, Representative Norris, and thank you, Representative Swazinski. So let's go to testifiers, Valerie Dosland. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I represent, I'm here speaking on behalf of school districts from around the state. Thank you, Representative Norris and Representative Swazinski, for authoring these bills. Over the past several years, inflation has significantly increased the cost of materials, labors, and project financing for school district facility projects. Rising prices for steel, lumber, concrete, and other materials strain school district budgets, forcing difficult decisions about upgrades, maintenance, and new construction, and also has the potential impact to taxpayers, as both authors shared. These costs require districts to either reduce the scope of projects, delay improvements, or seek additional taxpayer funding. By exempting both bills by addressing the sales tax issue, provide financial relief and helps district keep pace with these rising costs. Additionally, this could also help districts focus on needed other investments. The proposed exemption also ensures that all school districts, regardless of size, location, or whether they seek a specific legislative request, have equitable access to this exemption, allowing for a fair and consistent relief across the state. Thanks for your time and consideration today.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, let's go to, thank you very much. Let's go to, and I think, Chair Gomez, we love all bills and taxes. We do. Mr. Jessen, careful there. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids. My name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I'm happy to be here to voice support for these two bills. I've also included a letter in your packets with support from a wide coalition of stakeholders. I understand these bills are being heard as kind of an umbrella of all those special law provisions. And like Representative Swedzinski said, the process doesn't have to work that way if we have this kind of statewide solution before us. Because in 2013, as Representative Swedzinski knows, the legislature enacted the changes that are intended to put this into law, but practically doesn't have that effect because of all the administrative burdens and liabilities that are placed on that. I'm not going to get into those details. I think those were covered really well. But it would create a refund process through the Department of Revenue, so that can be verified through rather than an upfront exemption. So it's a process that we know works through current law. I did just want to call that's why this proposal has garnered bipartisan support in the past. The House has been a leader, especially in this regard. Representative Norris authored this bill in 23. It was included in the omnibus tax bill. Just didn't make it across the finish line. Representative Swedzinski has authored this bill every biennium for almost a decade now. Mr. Chair, you carried this? I mean, I've been around for each of those years, too. But, Mr. Chair, you carried this bill in your 2017 omnibus tax bill. I think that one was called the Come Together Tax Bill. And it just didn't make it across the final finish line.
Or is that the Don't Stop Believin'?
So 2015 and 2016 were Don't Stop Believin', Mr. Chair. 2017 was Come Together.
Okay.
2018 was It Ain't My Fault. I've got a spreadsheet.
That's why he makes the big bucks, Mr. Chair.
Do you remember what the first one was, Mr. Jessen?
You may predate me by just a little bit, Mr. Chair, so you might have to enlighten me.
Smoking hot tax bill.
Okay.
I named that after. Well, forget it. We'll do smoking hot tax. So please proceed.
All right. Well, I just want to really emphasize that not every local government or nonprofit is aware of or able to navigate the complex legislative process. It doesn't really make sense long term for the legislature to say that construction materials for one project in one part of the state are not taxable when another identical project in another part of the state didn't introduce a bill and ends up paying sales tax. So I know that the revenue estimate's really high on this, but the budget outlook is what it is. I understand that, but I do appreciate the committee having the conversation on this, and we need to keep having this conversation and figure out ways that we at least can move in this direction, because it really, at the end of the day, it doesn't make sense for local governments to raise property taxes in order to pay the state sales tax. Nobody would ever design a system that way, but it's the system that we're currently operating in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, let's go back to the Don't Stop Believing tax bill. I want you to know that when Governor Dayton vetoed it, I stopped believing. So that's, as my mother, God rest her soul, taught me, Gregory, sometimes you just have to live with disappointment. That being said, okay. Questions for Mr. Jessen, and thank you for your testimony, Mr. Jessen. Questions for members? Okay, thank you very much. We have a virtual testifier, Jenny Mack, City Minister Nisswa. So if you could please state your name, who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, absolutely. Good morning, Chair Davids and Chair Gomez and members of the House Taxes Committee. For the record, my name is Jenny Mack. I am the City Administrator in Nisswa and past President of the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to remotely testify today in support of House File 618 and House File 1284. I would like to thank Representative Swedzinski and Representative Norris for their ongoing work on this issue. The League supports this legislation to make it easier for cities and other local governments to utilize the existing sales tax exemption for building materials on public projects in a more streamlined process and equal treatment for cities across the state. The current process to get the exemption is cumbersome, expensive, and it increases liability to cities, which prevents many, including small cities like Nisswa, from utilizing it, ultimately driving up project costs to the local property taxpayer. Cities across the state are working to repair and modernize public infrastructure to ensure consistency in providing critical services to residents. With the uncertainty of getting support from a bonding bill or the authority to enact a local sales tax, local governments know that these projects must be completed and the costs are ultimately falling on local property tax bases. For perspective on the rising cost of infrastructure projects, in 2017, the city of Nisswa implemented a road bond cycle where every 7 years, the city plans to issue a road bond to make the necessary road improvements required in our community. The city issued a road bond in 2018 for $1.5 million to make improvements to just over 5 miles of roads. Now, 7 years later, we are working on our next road bond issuance, and for roughly the same miles of roads, the city is looking at a cost of over $4 million for these improvements, which is 2.5 times larger than the 2018 bond issue. For this upcoming bond, the estimated sales tax cost on just the bituminous materials is over $175,000. This amount is significant to Nisswa, and it would be beneficial to have a streamlined process to bring those dollars back to the local Nisswa taxpayer. As we know, different types of tax can have different impacts to a community, whether local, regional, or statewide. It is essential for anyone tasked with the work of governing, from either an elected or appointed official's perspective, to consider how to balance the needs of providing for and paying for the essential and demanded services to its residents, businesses, and visitors. As legislators, you are tasked with difficult decisions to balance this year's budget, and this provision may be difficult to achieve. Local governments are also working hard to balance their budgets, and we appreciate the strong fiscal partnership with the state. We appreciate the committee's time today and hope for the inclusion of House File 618 and House File 1284 in the final omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Max. Any questions for Ms. Max? Home of the Warriors, Nisswa, right?
Yep, Brainerd School District, yeah.
Okay, Warriors, yep, very good. Just want to make sure you knew that. Okay. Any questions for Ms. Max? Thank you very much for that testimony. Okay, let's go to the department. Member questions? Okay, then Representative Swedzinski renews his motion that House File 618 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Swedzinski. And then we, Representative Norris moves House File 1248 that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Any questions on that one? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, we are laying it over for possible inclusion. So now let's go to item last, but not least, of course. We will go to Representative Robbins. If you could please go to the testifier table. Any amendments on this one?
Yeah.
Okay. So Representative Robbins moves House File 2197. I do not see any amendments, so please present your bill, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have I can't even remember the number, 2197, which is a bill to provide middle-class tax relief for the taxpayers who were promised it in the 2023 tax bill but didn't actually receive it. So as many of you may know, Minnesota has a huge marriage penalty built into our tax code. There's a great body of research out there that I spared you in your packets, but I think one distribution is coming around from the Niskanen Center that outlines how important it is that we eliminate the marriage penalty in our tax code because children tend to do better, to quote the study, in stable two-parent households. And I would like to point out for members that the Niskanen Center is a center-left think tank. It's not a right-wing conspiracy think tank that we've been accused of in other committees. And their research on this is very credible. And what they find is that Minnesota has a significant marriage penalty built into our tax code, and this was from November of 2024. So just to outline, in 2024, the standard deduction in Minnesota had a significant marriage penalty of $7,280. In 2025, that's actually going to increase to $7,400 just for our standard deduction. In the working family credit, which combines with the child tax credit for the phase-out, for this year, 2025, the marriage penalty is $5,960. So what my bill does is eliminate the marriage penalty, not on the standard deduction, just on the working family credit portion, and it will increase the phase out from the current $31,950 to $37,910. And that will bring many more people able to take advantage of this, and it will help families who didn't get tax cuts last time have that benefit this time. So basically, the increase is for the single filers from the 31 to the 37, but the ultimate phase out goes up to 75. So that's a significant increase in who qualifies for the working family credit and the child credit. And this is paid for, members, by reducing the working family credit for people who get the working family credit who do not have children. So they are currently getting the working family credit, but they do not have children. They certainly qualify for many other benefits. So I just want members to note in the fiscal note that this is actually basically revenue neutral. So I know we heard a bill to eliminate the marriage penalty earlier in session, but it was extremely expensive. And while I would fully support that bill if we were not looking at a $6 billion deficit, the reality is we cannot afford to eliminate the marriage penalty that way. So that is why I'm bringing forward this bill, because we are removing a refundable tax credit from people who don't have children who currently get the working family credit, but it's so that we can expand the phase out for people who do have children and would benefit greatly from this. So I know there's probably a lot of questions, but basically that's what the bill does, and I would look forward to the discussion. Thank you, members. I think there's some testifiers.
Yes, thank you. Let's do that. Let's go to them next. Thank you, Chair Robbins. Let's go to Ms. Nan Madden, and then I have an Alexandra Fitzsimmons. Let's start with Ms. Madden. If you could please state your name and who represents for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nan Madden, I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. I want to thank Representative Robbins for her attention to the child tax credit and the interest in expanding, which truly is a nation-leading policy that could be transformational for many Minnesota kids and families. However, I am testifying in strong opposition to the portion of the bill that would eliminate the working family credit for households without dependent children. Those who would be harmed by this bill could come from the same communities and even the same families that the bill aims to help. It could be their adult children, their nieces or nephews, brothers or sisters, aunts or uncles, neighbors or friends. The bill would increase eligibility for the child tax credit for married couples with two or more children to above $100,000 of household income, while the Minnesotans who would be harmed by the bill have incomes below about $35,000 for single filers and $41,000 for married filers. More than 30 states, including Minnesota, have credits like the working family credit that are based on the federal earned income tax credit. The federal earned income tax credit included eligibility for workers without dependent children in 1993, and it has long been part of our Minnesota working family credit as well. Lower-income workers without children are the only group that the federal tax system taxes into poverty or deeper into poverty, mainly because their earned income tax credit is so small. Here at the state level, Minnesota has built a stronger working family credit that offsets a portion of the state and local taxes, such as sales taxes, that these lower income workers pay. Compared to tax credits available to families with children, the amount of tax credit that workers without dependent children can receive is much smaller, and they lose eligibility at a lower income level. So some specifics about the Minnesota Working Family Credit for workers without dependent children. Qualifying taxpayers must not be a dependent of another taxpayer. They need to be ages 19 to 65. They must have earned income to qualify. The maximum amount of tax credit they can receive this year is just $369. And as I said, the income limits are about $35,000 for singles and $41,000 for married filing joint filers. When low-income workers get the working family credit, they can better get by and better afford things that they need to get to and stay on the job, whether that's transportation to work or work boots, tools, or uniforms. With today's tight labor market, we can't afford to have potential workers sitting on the sidelines because they have financial challenges to getting their foot in the door. And one last thing that I'd like to share. A number of years ago when we were looking to expand the working family credit to younger workers, we talked to young people and asked them what would they do if they got an extra $100 from an expanded working family credit. These young workers said they would use those resources to buy necessities for home and work or invest in themselves and their futures. And they also spoke with pride about how they could strengthen their communities by spending these dollars in their own neighborhoods. Members, I'm asking you please to not try to make one type of family better off by taking dollars away from other Minnesotans who are struggling to make ends meet. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Madden. Any questions for Ms. Madden? Thank you so much. Let's go to Alexander Fitzsimmons. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. CDF Minnesota advocates for policies and programs that improve the well-being of children and increase the economic security of families. We focus particular attention to Minnesota children who have been pushed to the margins. I first want to thank Representative Robbins for expanding the Child Tax Credit in House File 2197, thereby improving the financial stability of families and overall well-being of children. Though we are Children's Defense Fund, we have long advocated for policies and programs that support a child's transition to young adulthood, working to ensure the critical passage is a time of stability, opportunity, and promise. As such, I'm here today to raise some concerns about the Working Family Credit provisions in House File 2197. We're very concerned that eliminating the working family credit for households without dependent children will harm many young people who live independently from their families or are part of families with low incomes and fewer resources and supports. Before I briefly address our concerns, I want to touch upon how we talk about and developmentally categorize young people. According to the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Partnership for Adolescent and Young Adult Health, there are three stages to adolescence. Early adolescence, which are ages 10 to 14, middle adolescence, ages 15 to 17, and then later adolescence, ages 18 to 24. For the purposes of the working family credit provisions in this bill, we'll be looking at later adolescence. Adolescent development is a process that all youth experience as they move through adolescence toward adulthood. Interestingly, it is second only to early childhood in terms of the significance of physical and cognitive development. There are specific developmental tasks that all youth need to accomplish to enter adulthood well prepared, one of which is meeting the demands of increasingly mature roles and responsibilities. Activities like having a full-time job, timely paying bills, meeting basic needs, and filing your taxes. Young people who successfully complete these developmental tasks are better prepared to make a successful transition from adolescence into adulthood. Again, keeping in mind that under the developmental framework I just provided, adulthood doesn't actually begin until age 25. As such, 18 to 25-year-olds are in a place of limbo. Many young people with low incomes face significant barriers to stability and mobility. Research documents that adequate income is an essential component of stability for these young people. These young people face the highest poverty rates of any age group in Minnesota. In 2023, there were 83,000 18 to 24-year-olds living in poverty in Minnesota. That's 18% of our 18 to 24-year-old population. As this committee knows, the Working Family Credit plays an important role in reducing poverty, encouraging work, and meeting basic needs. These benefits are especially important for young Minnesotans preparing to enter adulthood. We urge you to support the health, well-being, and economic security of low-income Minnesotans and maintain the Working Family Credit for households without dependent children. Thank you for your dedication to the young people of Minnesota who are our future parents, caregivers, and public servants. We're grateful for your service.
And thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Fitzsimmons? Any questions from the department? Okay. So let's go to member questions in general. Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me start with just a comment that last biennium I actually carried a bill. I was kind of disappointed in my tax chair. She didn't include it, but to expand the Working Family Tax Credit for the people who don't have children, adults who don't have children, that you are removing from the Working Family Tax Credit in this bill. So you can imagine that I have some concerns about what you've done here. But I, you know, unsurprisingly to probably many people, I find myself agreeing entirely with Nan Madden. In that I think that part of this bill I like quite a bit. I like the idea of increasing access to the child tax credit. And my disappointment with Chair Gomez was tempered by the historic child tax credit, which pulled a record number of children out of poverty. I thought that was a pretty good idea. So, you know, it balances out. But in any event, but I have to admit, I'm a little intrigued by your bill, because what your bill does is it increases a tax expenditure for one group of people, and it pays for it by reducing a tax expenditure for another group of people. And if that's something that we're prepared to do as a committee this year, I think there might be some opportunities for bipartisan work here that I want to explore today. I really do. So I wonder if instead of getting rid of the Working Family Tax Credit for childless people, you know, we have, for example, a deduction on mortgage interest for second homes in Minnesota, which, you know, the real money in that, in terms of if we got rid of that, that would generate significant funds for the state that could be used to offset the cost of expanding the working family tax or the child tax credit to more families. And I wonder if instead of getting rid of a tax credit that benefits people with incomes, I think we were saying below $30,000 or $35,000, if the author would be open to getting rid of the mortgage interest deduction for second homes instead.
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm certainly open to lots of conversations about how we can better align the tax code to our priorities. And I think there's a lot of places that we could look to find tax expenditure savings. But what I would point out from the tax expenditure report from the 2023 bill is that the people who benefited the most out of the 2023 tax bill, which was, you know, a huge redistribution of tax funds from the middle class to the lower income families, the bottom five quartiles benefited the most, and that was paid for by tax increases on the upper five quartiles. So starting at $66,000, those are the Minnesotans, $66,000 and up, who got tax increases, and people making less than that all got tax cuts or expanded refunds. And so we've already seriously taxed the middle class in the 2023 bill, and we promised middle-class tax cuts, but that's not what was delivered. So my bill is an attempt to make good on the promise where people were told, oh, you're getting a tax cut, when in fact they did not. And the people who currently benefited from the 2023 bill in the lower deciles, they, yes, If we hadn't spent $18 billion and raised taxes $11 billion already, and we didn't have a $6 billion deficit, I would not want to take money from this group. But the reality is the only way we can expand affordability for people in the middle class is to find the money. We have to pay for it. And so that's what this bill does. I have found a small way by taking money from the working family credit for people who, in fact, are working but do not have children to help people who have children. And if the committee is not on board with that, I'm okay with that, I guess. I wanted to present an alternative because the earlier version we heard of this where we eliminated the marriage penalty was incredibly expensive. And we all can talk a good game and say we want to reduce the marriage penalty. But unless we find a way to pay for it, we, in fact, cannot do that. And as the Niskanen Center study points out, we have an outlier on a marriage penalty in this state. And if we want to really find ways to support families, there's untold research on the improvements for women and children in stable two-parent households. I'm a co-chair with Senator Pappas on the Economic Status of Women Commission. When we heard multiple hearings on this during the interim. So if we want to be serious about supporting stable families, economic security for women and children, this is a way we can do it. It is not perfect, but we are in this situation because we overspent and overtaxed when we had an $18 billion surplus. So I'm looking for solutions, and if the committee doesn't agree, I will respect your decision. But this is a viable solution, not a pie in the sky, oh, we want to do something about the marriage penalty, but we all know we can't afford it solution.
Chair Stevenson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, I don't think it's a viable solution to take away a tax credit from the, you know, poorest of the working poor in our state in order to expand the child tax credit. Now, I presented you with an idea. I was glad to hear that you didn't dismiss it outright, although then you went on a much longer answer where you seemed to be saying that this is the only way that works. I think that if we can come together and say that maybe there's some tax expenditures that benefit the wealthiest Minnesotans that we want to set aside, you know, maybe there would be some interest in trying to expand the child tax credit to more families. I would be interested in that. I'm not interested in taking away the working family tax credit from people who make less than $30,000 a year. I'll tell you, the reason why I introduced that bill to expand the working family tax credit was that in the fall of 2022, I talked to so many people at the doors who, you know, had kids but were a little older. Their kids were out of the house. And they're working, they're trying, and they're struggling. And I thought, you know, we should try to do something to make life a little bit more affordable for those people also, not just younger people with kids. I want to help them too. I was glad that we did that in 2023. But I think it's really, really, frankly, abhorrent that we would punish those people when we have other tax expenditures that are right now benefiting the wealthiest Minnesotans that we could use to pay for this. And that's my point, is just, you know, if we're gonna go down this road of canceling tax expenditures in order to pay for other tax expenditures, why on earth would we do that for people who are struggling just to get by when we have the opportunity with other people who, you know, have a second home or have, I mean, that's great. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. But I don't know why we would choose to go after people who are struggling so much when we have other avenues available to us. I guess that's my only point, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. A response, Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would just point out that I'm very open. If we want to take the EV bike tax credit, if we want to take some of those other tax credits, I'm very open to that discussion. When I first worked on this bill, our nonpartisan staff helped me come up with this solution because it's in the same pocket of how the budget works. But if there are ways to cross across accounts that are workable, I'm very open to that discussion. And I would also like to just note for the record, Mr. Chair, that the people in the lowest income deciles also receive a lot of other state support already. They get SNAP benefits, they get medical assistance, they get the renters or the housing credit. I had a list somewhere. I don't have the entire list in front of me. But there are multiple supports the state is already providing to people on the low income. And I think if we're looking to help deliver affordability and tax cuts to the middle class, we have to take a serious look at all of these programs.
The gentleman from Lyon. Excuse me, Chair Stevenson, were you?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's fine.
Okay, the gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Chair. Jeez Louise. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a shout out, you know, I think we did a lot. There was a lot of Minnesotans that heard the stories, as Representative Stevenson said, that there were a lot of folks hurting during the campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, from the Biden administration and really the downturn in the economy, the increased costs when it comes to all the products across the board, whether it be gasoline and the rest. And, you know, we do live in a world. You know, in the United States, we kind of live in a bubble as far as if we want more money, we can print more money. But in the reality, when it comes to a state budget, and that's what Representative Kristen Robbins is really addressing, is that we do have finite resources. We do not have a printing press unless the federal government kicks it in the gear. And so we do need to make priorities. And what Representative Robbins' bill does is make a priority to kids and to children and to families. And when we live in a world of finite resources, which we do, that focusing these dollars on those that need it most, those unincurred consequences of all sorts of things, the cost of things going up, the cost of life, kids, school. You know, if you're a family that's in a failing school and you have no way out, this would maybe give a few more dollars in your pocket to help maybe get a tutor, do whatever that might be. To help your children in the most vulnerable years of their lives, whether it's middle class, whether that's wherever it's at. And really, that's the focus. And I appreciate Representative Robbins carrying this bill. And the idea that it's abhorrent to prioritize children is, I don't get that. And I appreciate the focus on this. And Representative Robbins, I completely support your bill. You know, I hope that we can make kids a priority in this state. You know, you look at what's going on globally. We have birth rates dropping. China, Europe. The United States happens to be something a little bit higher than the rest of the world right now, but barely. Replacement rates, who's going to be that next worker? Who's going to be that next entrepreneur? You know, regardless of other policies that we choose to state and support with our tax policy, with preborns and the rest, but prioritizing kids is the right move. And I would hope that as this legislative body moves forward, as this committee moves forward, that we choose the Representative Robbins bill to be placed in a omnibus bill. So thank you.
Okay, Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, do you support increasing taxes for low-income Minnesotans?
Representative Robbins. Chair Robbins.
Do you support increasing taxes for low-income Minnesotans, Representative Robbins?
Madam Chair.
Okay, so what we have before us,
thank
you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, what we have before, we're using a little bit of euphemistic language here today. We're talking about reducing a tax expenditure or taking away a tax credit. What that is a tax increase. It says in black and white in our materials, House File 2197 would increase taxes on 300,000 Minnesota tax filers. House File 20, it increases taxes. It says it in black and white. It says it in the memo from Sean Williams on the first page. It says it in the revenue estimate. On the second page of the revenue estimate, 318,700 returns would see a tax increase under this proposal. So make it make sense, Representative Robbins. If you don't support increasing taxes on the lowest income Minnesotans, then what's going on with this bill, please?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. So I when I got that modeling estimate from Mr. Williams, I called him and I'm like, how are you calling this a tax increase? And he said, oh, well, that's just sort of the lingo, but it is a reduction in the refundable credit. So they are receiving less in a refund because they don't have tax liability. So they are not getting a tax increase. They are not paying taxes. So their refund is being lowered. And that actually reminds me of a point I wanted to make earlier, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind. If Mr. Williams would be willing to speak to this, my understanding is that one of the reasons we need to increase these thresholds, which is what my bill does, is increases the phase out on the working family credit and the child tax credit, is because there's been an opinion submitted that with the thresholds this low, it's actually going to adversely affect what people receive in SNAP benefits. So we need to increase these thresholds, members, and we have to find a way to pay for it. So, Mr. Williams, if you wouldn't mind speaking to that, I forgot to ask you earlier.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Davids and members, so I believe what Representative Robbins is speaking to, I think that there was a decision by the USDA, I believe it was in 2024, about the advanced payments process for the child credit. And so I think that the Department of Revenue spoke with the USDA about potentially getting a waiver for SNAP purposes to determine if those advanced payments would count towards income for the purposes of SNAP eligibility. And my understanding is that the USDA said essentially is because those payments are periodic, they're made over sort of multiple instances, those advanced payments of the child credit would be considered income for the purposes of SNAP eligibility.
Representative Robbins, you have the floor, then we'll go to.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. So members, this is an issue that we haven't addressed yet that actually we do need to address, and raising the thresholds is one way to address that.
Mr. Chair.
Gomez.
Thank you. I have the floor, and
yes,
I and I understand if Representative Robbins needs to make another point, but I was sort of in the middle of having the floor, and then she decided to go and bring up an unrelated issue, because I actually really do want to talk about the fact that this bill raises income taxes. However you want to talk about it, it raises taxes on 300,000 Minnesotans. What a credit does is it buys down tax liability. There's some portion of it that's refundable in this case, but there's no way to kind of twist yourself into pretzels to say that this is not a literal tax increase on the most vulnerable Minnesotans, the lowest income Minnesotans. It says it literally in black and white. Like you can twist it around, but it's literally twice in our materials in front of us today. So that's one thing. There's been a lot said here, though. I mean, and so you did include and referred to the fact that the bottom 50% of tax, or the lowest, the Minnesota taxpayers with the lowest 50% of household income disproportionately were the ones who got benefits in 2023. And you caught me, Representative Robbins, you caught me doing like literally precisely what I say every day in this committee that I want to do. And that is to ensure that our tax code is not just an instrument for giving out goodies to millionaires and billionaires and corporations, but that it is a way for us to introduce some equity into what is undeniably an inequitable economy that we're existing in right now. But to say that we, you know, you can look at this document that you gave us, and you know, 3.22%. Okay, sorry. So the overwhelming like burden of what we did in 2023 falls on the top quartile, and then the top decile, the 10th decile, and then you can look at the detail. We're talking about most of this going to the top 1%. And so I understand if you have a problem, right, with reducing child poverty and giving tax credits and tax cuts to low-income people. But, like, you can't, I mean, I guess you can say whatever you want to say. You can say that it's unfair. personally, like, I think it's unfair that we have an economy where we have allowed just total unfettered accumulation of wealth and income in fewer and fewer hands, and more working people are trying and failing to get by with increased housing costs, increased healthcare costs, increased childcare costs. I just want to turn here to the phase outs for the child tax credit. And Representative Hansen has talked to us about some of these issues. Because you talk about, I mean, what you're introducing here is a single mom penalty. That's what you're introducing into the child tax credit. Because we specifically designed it in acknowledgement of the fact that if you only have one income in your household, it doesn't, like, make it easier to meet your cost burden of raising a kid. It makes it harder. And so when we originally designed this, we have the threshold for single filers and head of household filers, the phase out threshold, is not that far away from the married filing joint filers. But the idea that we would then increase the phase outs for married filing joint returns, like this is on the front of the revenue estimate. So currently the phase out threshold for tax year 2025 is 37.9 for MFJ, 31.950 for all other filers. What you do is you take the 37.9 up to 75,000 and then the 31.9 to 37.5. And so what you're introducing then is you're putting a bunch of money into this and you're saying, if you're a single parent, we're making this a worse deal for you. We're making it a worse deal for you, for your household. So, I mean, you know, obviously, like, you have information here about marriage penalties. Those cut both ways when you are designing a program, which is what we were doing, with limited dollars, which is what we were doing, and trying to maximize the anti-poverty impact of that program. That's what you see in the design of this. So the idea of then, like, saying that we're going to have a single mom penalty that we're adding based, you know, if you compare it to current law, is, it's really hard for me to understand. You know, I think that in a land of unlimited resources, certainly we would want to move the thresholds up. We would want to move the benefits of the child tax credit out to a larger group of people. But what you're doing here is quite literally taking from the lowest income Minnesotans and you know, you talk about redistribution. This is redistribution too, but it's just from poor people to slightly, like, to lower middle class people. So, you know, I have a real problem with that part of it. You know, the other piece here that's very interesting to me that Chair Stevenson talked about is that suddenly we want to pay for tax cuts. Suddenly we want to pay for tax expenditures. Because, you know, we heard a bill not long ago, House File 173, to expand the R&D credit, $60 million. Or wait, is this for the year? So it's $120 million a biennium you were proposing to give out to the largest corporations in the world who have Nexus in Minnesota. And there was no effort to pay for that one. So why do we think that if we're trying to extend tax benefits to low-income families, we absolutely must pay for them? But if we're trying to extend tax benefits to the biggest corporations in the world, there's no need to bother? That's a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to get through all your points. I've been taking notes. So I do think we need to pay for tax cuts, whether it's to corporations or data centers or individuals. We need to pay for tax cuts because we have a deficit. $6 billion. Minnesotans are fed up. They cannot afford more tax increases. So we have to find ways to cut spending and right-size this state government. The state of Minnesota grew the state budget 38% over 2 years in the last cycle. That's completely unsustainable. Our taxpayers cannot afford it. And every day at the doors, I know you all heard it too, people are fed up with how much they're paying, and they literally can't afford it. So I'm looking for ways to pay for tax cuts, and I agree we should pay for all of them. Secondly, I can't remember. Let me look through my notes here for a second.
Can we stay on that for Mr. Chair?
Chair Gomez.
Because I appreciate if, in principle, you believe that we need to pay for tax cuts. But we have seen two bills from you in the last 2 weeks. One of them is a benefit, is a child tax credit increase that you felt compelled within the bill to pay for it by cutting benefits, by increasing taxes on 300,000 other Minnesotans. So that was important enough when we were extending the child tax credit to raise taxes on other people. But when you brought $120 million worth of corporate giveaways, you didn't feel compelled to offer a pay for inside of that bill. Why is that, Representative Robbins?
Mr. Chair, can the questions be focused on this bill, please?
Members, we're out of time here. So what we're going to do is we're not going to lay it over for possible conclusion. I'm going to lay the bill over. We're going to bring it up Thursday, first bill. And also, for your information, the governor's bill, we're going to hear, that's my bill, isn't it?
The Davids bill.
Davids Gomez Walls bill. We will be hearing that next Wednesday, a week from tomorrow. So just put that in your calendars. We're going to hear the governor's bill, the Davids Gomez bill, and we'll pick up on the Robbins bill as the first bill we hear on Thursday. So if we'd be very good points being brought up, we'd be concise because we'll have Republican and Democrat bills coming up on Thursday. So please keep House File 2197 in your save file. And with that, good government all the time, we're adjourned.